Welcome to the Busy Girls Book Club. We are a podcast that rates and reviews all of Book Talk's most popular and talked about books and tell you whether or not you should fit them into your busy young professional schedule. I'm Catherine.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Caitlin. And we have a first ever for you here on Busy Girls Book Club. We have an interview today with someone who gets to kind of set the pace of what people are reading in the book world, but also a friend of mine from college, so kind of fun to reconnect. So we have Lauren Puckett Pope with us. Lauren, do you want to say hi and share a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'd love to. Hi, everyone. So nice to meet you. As Caitlin said, I'm Lauren Puckett Pope. I'm a staff culture writer at Elle Magazine, and I cover a lot of things under the umbrella of culture, but a huge part of that for me anyway is books. So this is a really exciting conversation for me to be having tonight.
And we're excited because Lauren is also a Mizzou Journalism School grad. So we're just, you know, raking them in here.
Mizzou Mafia showing up as usual. I love it.
Okay, well, just to start off, you know, we are all still like in our 20s. I think you're still in your 20s, right? Yeah.
Just barely.
Yep.
Tail end.
Right. But like you're writing about books and TV and stuff for Elle, and that is a big deal. So was that always the dream? How did you get here? And what does your daily life look like?
Okay, so there's a simple answer to this question and a more complicated one. So I'll try
drama.
And do a combination of both, I guess. Yes, writing was always the dream since I was like 4, probably. And journalism even has, you know, been the dream for many years, probably since high school at least. Culture writing and writing about books in particular was something that I always loved, but for reasons that are perhaps better worked out in therapy, I was convinced for a long time that culture writing was not going to be, you know, a feasible career path. And there's lots of valid reasons for thinking that's the case. Depending on the job market, it is the case. But my own reasons for believing in sort of the futility of the pursuit had more to do with sort of a personal inferiority complex. And I was surrounded by a lot of brilliant people in journalism school whom I really respected, and they were doing what I deemed at the time sort of really important work. And I think I just felt very intimidated by that, I suppose. And anyway, in grad school, I started freelancing about books because it was a niche that I could carve out in what was a really huge and terrifying freelance market. And I was very new to it, but I knew books. And, you know, so later I got a job as an executive assistant at Hearst Magazines, which is the parent company of Elle, where I work now. And I started pitching magazines like Esquire and Harper's Bazaar and Cosmopolitan and Elle as well. And what I found myself pitching probably 9 times out of 10 were culture stories, stories about TV and movies and books that had been made into TV and movies. And I realized that I had been running from something that I absolutely loved because I was afraid of failing at a pursuit that actually I thought was extremely important. I was just worried no one else was going to think it was important. And after moving up from that assistant role to an associate editor, staff culture writer position, I realized over the course of that time how I was, you know, I was wrong on both counts. You know, I believe culture writing is brilliant and vital and worth shaping your career around. And readers believe that too. So like I said, long spiel, but what I do now is, a lot of different things, but most of it is consuming and thinking about it and talking to people about it and then trying to distill it onto the page in a way that readers not only find useful and interesting, but also that sort of engages with the wider world in a way that they can use to make sense of what I think feels like, and in many ways is, an increasingly fragmented reality. This is not an original thing that I'm saying right now, but a lot of authors will talk about how it often feels like the best way that you can get to a core truth is through a work of fiction or a work of storytelling. And I think that that's very true, and maybe even more true now than ever. So yeah, that's the general idea of what I do. I can dig into specifics if you really would like me to get into it, but I don't want to bore you to tears.
That is so cool. And I like have so much respect for you being so young, being like talking to these like really important magazines. And I'm kind of curious, like, you know, there are so many great books in the world. What made you want to like pitch an article about a book? What is the difference between a book that you would want to write about versus a book you might, you know, not write a whole article solely devoted to?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if I've ever had it posed to me in that. I've had the question of like, how do you choose which books to write about? But that's a little bit different than like books that I choose to pitch back when I was freelancing. So that's an interesting question. I think it's a combination of things. It's, you know, the usual stuff of, is there a compelling story in the first place? Is the author someone who has something to say? If it's an interview, does the author themselves have an intriguing backstory or something that they're trying to get out there? Is it relevant for, you know, any number of reasons? And I don't even mean relevant in like, is there a social event that's going on or whatever, but more just like, is this a conversation starter in a way that people will recognize? But I think for me personally, a big part of a reason why I would want to pitch a certain idea was usually because I would read the book and I would have a question afterwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a long time as a reader, that is not, you don't get to ask the questions. And to some degree, that's the joy of reading, right? Is that you have to sit with the questions and you get to kind of try and figure them out on your own. And I still deeply love and appreciate that and think it's actually a really, really important part of reading is not having answers to questions. I think I saw a tweet the other day and I cannot remember who it was. It was an author I really respect, but someone tweeted something the other day about how books are, I'm going to butcher it, but it was something about like books don't answer questions. All they do is ask questions. And I think that's largely true. All that is to say, I thought the opportunity to try and answer those questions or even just ask them out loud maybe was intriguing. And so there were certain books where I'd really, really be like, oh my God, like this is eating at me. And I'd want to ask the author, like, what were you thinking when you did this? Or like, what does this mean to you? And so a lot of it was just that, like, you know, I just personally, maybe even like selfishly, was just like, I gotta know. And then, you know, something that you'll learn as you do this long enough is that a lot of times if you have those questions yourself, other people will have similar or at least adjacent questions.
I am so fascinated by your job because I wish I had it because it's honestly so freaking right? Cool.
Getting paid to read books and watch cool films and stuff.
No, that'd be so cool.
It is. I love it. It's a lot. I can get into the downsides, but I do love it very, very much.
I mean, yeah, I guess every job has downsides and journalism is a very fast paced industry that we all know is a lot, can take a lot out of you, but that's super cool.
It's a descriptor for it, for sure.
A lot. But I think I've always thought about this recently because we talk about book talk and that's where we get a lot of our inspiration for books. But like social media has driven such like this change and like this community of book lovers coming together. So how has that kind of impacted your writing about books and stuff, like looking at book talk and book Twitter and book Instagram?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are not paying any attention to that as a reporter, you're sort of divorced from the reality that we're in now. And I say that carefully only because I think the flip side of that, or the other side of that coin, sorry, is that
from the Midwest, other side of that.
Yeah, exactly. The other side of the corn. It's fine. It's just a Midwest thing. Is that you get too dependent on that and too sucked into it. And suddenly, you know, the only thing that you're talking about is Sarah J. Maas, which, look, I'm happy to talk about Sarah J. Maas. I think we all should be talking about Sarah J. Maas for a lot of reasons, but you know, that's, I'm being a little facetious, but that's, you know, 90% of what you see on Book Talk.
We fall into that trap regularly here.
Yes.
But you get what I'm saying. Yes. Exactly. Like when that's so much of what you see, consuming. Yes, exactly. Like you, there's a lot that you can miss. So, you know, but at the same time, I do think it's really important, as it is in all fields of study, to recognize the echo chamber, right? If it exists, then people are in it. And if you're going to be reporting on it, then you need to know about it. So I love Book Talk. I follow a number of book talkers. I have dabbled here and there in book talking, if that is a verb, sure. You know, and we'll go with it. And I think, for one thing, what it has done for me personally is showed me in a perhaps more visceral, tangible way how much interest there really is. Because it's one thing to look at sales numbers and those types of things, which I do look at that, and that is an important part of you know, measuring interest. But it's another thing to see sort of the excitement and these rich, I mean, because they're rich conversations that happen on TikTok. And so it's been really vital to me in finding out not only just like what people are reading, but what are they interested in, and what are the genres, and what are the trends that are going on. And I try really hard not to condemn these forms of book community that are less established. It doesn't mean I don't think that there are necessary delineations between the two, for sure, but I still think it's a really vital community and should be treated as one. So
there are toxic sides, like shooting down new books before they even hit the market. And I've seen commentary on fast fashion, but fast books with like Kindle Unlimited and things. So like, it's definitely something we also try and keep in mind a little bit when we're choosing books, is like, okay, like TikTok says this, but let's go check out, you know, Goodreads and Amazon and whatever else. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's, you know, an instinct that is increasingly difficult, maybe, or I don't know if it's increasingly difficult or if it's just that, like, it's not emphasized as much, but this instinct to actually take the time to be like, oh, is this good? Or is this just what everyone is saying is good? Or, you know, oh, is
welcome to the point of our podcast.
I have been burned so many times.
We've all been burned. And look, I actually am a big believer in reading quote unquote bad book. Well, not quote unquote. There are bad books out there. I'll say it. But you know, I'm a big believer in that. I think it's important to read those books. I think it's important to talk about why they're bad. I think it's, you know, all of those types of things. I think that's a vital part of sort of the ecosystem of reading and writing and publishing and yada yada. I think the problem I see sometimes is exactly what you're saying, which is if it moves so quickly and you don't have any time and you don't take the time to actually sit and do literary criticism, which has gets all sorts of connotations involved that people don't like, but that's what it is, right? Like that's what you guys are doing. You're doing a form of literary criticism. You might not advertise it that way, and that's fine, but that's a form of what you're doing. So it's important. People care about that stuff. They want to know how to spend their money and their time, and also like how to, once they've spent their money and their time, make that thing that they've consumed more meaningful to to themselves and do something with it, ideally. Yeah, I don't know.
That is so well said.
I don't know about that, but thank you. That's very kind.
I do want to ask, just so we have some context as we kind of talk about books you've been reading coming up. I saw you put out your call out on social media for authors to send you books that, you know, they might want you to review and consider for What Elle's covering this year. How many books did you end up with?
So I specifically go out of my way not to count the galleys that I receive because I don't want to overwhelm myself with how many I know that I'll just never get to. But I do think in December, I did count a group of them, and there were, 140, 142. But that was only a group I'd already whittled down. So at the end of the day, it was probably a few hundred by the time the packages stopped arriving. But the packages are always arriving, so like the numbers always keep changing.
Oh my god!
It's a lot. But that, like, an embarrassment of riches, right? You know, like, I'm never going to complain about getting books. Like, that's the thing you dream about.
Well, and clearly, right? Authors think you're a voice worth, you know, sharing their work with, because so that's important too. Like, that's credibility to you for how many you get.
Totally. And I hope that is the case. You know, I mean, I want authors, publicists, editors, readers to see Elle and me as an extension of Elle, as someone who really does, or as someone and as a brand that really does care about this community. I mean, there's a lot of really rich books coverage out there, but there's also a lot of really like just sort of scraping the surface books coverage. And I don't condemn that either, because I understand the limited resources that a lot of outlets, a lot of blogs, a lot of, you know, et cetera, are working with. But I do want authors to know that when they are, you know, sending their book to Elle, or when a publicist is pitching Elle, that we're taking it seriously, that, you know, this is, we're doing literary criticism, you know, of some form or another. It does matter to authors. I think that's the thing maybe that I've been more blown away by than anything else, is just the level to which this work is appreciated in sort of the whole sphere. I mean, I've been doing culture writing of different forms for a while now, and I've never had quite the same experience as I have had with the book community, of just like, not that there isn't toxicity, there's plenty of toxicity, but there is this just sort of like desire for conversation and wherever that conversation is coming from. And I think there's a real hunger for it too. And some of that has to do with the fact that there is so much less of it in these sort of establishment media publications. And, you know, the way that we converse about books in general is really different, but there's still so much of an appetite for it, which I think is probably something I should have known or did know in the back of my mind, but seeing it and seeing the response that I have seen has been really, I mean, validating for sure, but also just exciting and encouraging. It's what I have always hoped would be the case. And it's cool to see that at least in certain areas it is.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a lot. You know, that's a lot of authors and expectations and different stuff going on in movies and books, and there's always more. So you are kind of the ultimate busy girl, professionally. How do you like handle your own TBR and deadlines and managing all the books that you read?
Well, two things. One, yes, I'm definitely very busy, but I don't know that I'm any busier than most people. And, you know, I don't even have children or anything like that at this point. So you could make the argument that I have a lot more time than some people do. But I will say, let's get, you know, one thing out of the way, which is you're never going to be able to read all the books that publishers and authors want you to read, even if you also want to read them all. I read this fabulous column by Maris Kreisman over at LitHub a few weeks ago, and she wrote about how a lot of your job as a books writer is simply to manage your own guilt. You know, you're never going to have the time to read and consider everything that deserves to be read and considered. There aren't enough hours. So what I do manage is this. I consider every possible book that I can. I solicit galleys from publishers almost every day or every work day. I let authors and publicists and editors connect with me in my Instagram DMs if they have a book they'd like me to look into. I try to make myself really accessible because I recognize that publishing is not the most accessible industry. And there's just so many products within it that it can be really difficult to break through the noise. But anyway, so I consider all these books based on their plot summaries, their genres, if they sound like a good fit for Elle, if I'm familiar with the author, sometimes if a comp title catches my eye, I look at bookseller reviews to see, you know, are these ones I trust? And through all of that, I end up setting aside the ones that I want to consider deeper. I usually read through the first several pages to get kind of a better sense of the writing. And if those pages make an impression, I'll usually do more digging. I'll look at reviews. I'll read further. Some of those I'll end up reading in their entirety. And as many of them as I can, I'll read in their entirety. Others I ask my colleagues to read, or I add to my TBR for a later date. I usually try to get through at least one book a week, ideally two. On really good weeks, I can knock out three or four, but it just depends on my other, you know, job and personal obligations. You do your best.
We struggle to do our book a week some weeks, so.
Exactly, right?
I struggle every week, so.
Y'all get it. I mean, and that's the thing. And there's some weeks where it's zero. Like, you had a tough week and you couldn't, you know, especially if you're reading like a real doorstopper and you're like, this isn't going to happen for me. But do the best that you can.
Okay. So fair.
So we went through, well, I went through, I'd like kept tabs on your top books of 2023 article you'd had. Mm-hmm. And I went through today out of curiosity to see how many we'd read for the podcast. And out of 98 books, it was one.
Really? And this, wait, for 2023?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The only one we had read on the list was Happy Place. Like, there's others that are sitting on my shelf, like just not yet read, like, like Tom Lake and stuff. But so we clearly did not do a good job of, well, in the fantasy slump a lot.
So it's so interesting, actually, that you bring that up, because so this year for Elle's book coverage, we made the decision that instead of doing one big top reads of the year article, we were going to do five focused by genre. And it's something I really wish we'd started doing sooner, quite frankly, but it was just a time investment thing that I think we hadn't had time for. But I was realizing as, you know, we were putting our books as we were putting our books coverage together, that this isn't how people read. You know, they don't, when they're looking for a book, most of the time, they're not going to just go look and say, like, what are the best books of the year? They might be curious, sort of like, you know, if the New York Times does their 10 best books or whatever, or 100 notable books, like they're curious to see who makes the list. And like the Goodreads Choice Awards are certainly paid very close attention to. And that might direct some people's reading. But a lot of times they've already read those books, especially if it's within a genre or an author or whatever that they are already interested in. So I started thinking a lot about this and the fact that our like best books list was very heavily skewed toward literary fiction, for one thing. And also that I just didn't think we were serving readers in the best way that we could be. So that was behind the choice of we were going to do this year and still are literary fiction, nonfiction, fantasy and sci-fi, romance, and mysteries and thrillers. And Because that's the other thing too, is if you're doing one list, are you going to have 300 books on that list? You know, like it, there were a lot of issues with that format. So it's interesting actually that you just said that, because I'm kind of like, okay, this is proving my suspicion, which is that like, it was way too concentrated.
Okay. Well, that brings us to a question I'm very excited to hear the answer to. And that's, if you had like top five reads from 2023, what would they be?
That I read in 2023, or that were published in 2023 and that I read?
That you read in 2023.
So older ones that I went back and read in 2023 that I had originally missed, Babel by R.F. Kuang, which I was just so impressed by that book on multiple levels. I finally read Trick Mirror by Gia Tolentino, which is sort of cultural essay canon, as far as I'm concerned, or belongs to that canon. And then the book that I think I think about the most is Thick by Tressie McMillan Cottom. I believe I'm saying her name correctly. She is, as far as I'm concerned, probably one of our smartest, most, I don't even know, just astute, but funny and yeah, I have enormous respect
for essays. Her. Yeah, you like a book of essays.
Yeah, it's an excellent work of essays about her life, but about race and sort of America's. I don't want to give anything away, because it's a book that I really think needs to be experienced, just like, not without any like thoughts beforehand, but just sort of, how do I put this? It is something I think about every single week. And I revisit those essays a lot. And so I don't want to put any like ideas on it. Other than that, I really, really loved it and thought it was brilliant. But yeah, those are both essay collections. Ones that came out in 2023 that I loved, I really loved Homebodies by Tembi Denton Hurst, I believe is her name, or how you say her name. And Melissa Broder wrote Death Valley, or published Death Valley last year. And I thought that was a really fun one. Sad, but funny, which is what she does so well. And Doppelganger by Naomi Klein was a sort of essay. More topical, but essay-ish collection. And what else? Oh, Monsters. That's another essay collection. clearly, I do like the essay collections a lot. Monsters by Claire Dederer, I believe. And that book, it basically talks about art monsters is the idea. So these, mostly men, but also some women, who have created really remarkable works of art that people really love and appreciate, but they have done or did really terrible things as people. And how do you reconcile those two things? And it just deals with a lot of sort of naughty ethical questions that I think are really relevant, even years after the fact, and made me think a lot. This is stupid, but I love anything that makes me really like sit and slow down and think about something. Cause like I said, you know, when we first got on this chat, was we just don't really live in a time that encourages that, you know, in a very real, meaningful way. I think there's a lot of lip service to like sitting and thinking and quote unquote doing your own research, which has its own problems. But like, I love when I am really, truly like sitting and thinking about something and not doing something else, not, you know, doing my laundry at the same time or whatever. But like, I just get so blown back by something that I read that I have to sort of just sit and stare out a window for a few minutes and think about it. Like when that happens to me, it is, whew, there are few things that I relish as much as that, to be honest.
So it sounds like you have the most in common with Casey when it comes to reading. Yeah. Through.
I love lit fiction as well. So I'm happy to take your recommendations.
But we have at least read one of those for the podcast, and that was Babel. So we
did. That so one. Good. So good.
I liked much more than Catherine and Caitlin.
No, I liked it. It was good. Okay.
They said, now wait a second. Don't put words in our mouths. I think I've read plenty of criticism of that book that, and in fact, a fair amount of it, I think, is very valid. And I have my own criticisms of it, but I do think that book did something in the fantasy genre, that is not always encouraged in that genre. I'll put it that way. I mean, you can just look at the Hugo Awards and everything that, I don't know if you guys are into that whole drama, but that obviously has a lot to do with China. And again, I won't get into the weeds of it, but I do think it, you know, that book being wrapped up in a scandal like that, I think is very telling. And so anyway, it's another one of those books that I sat and thought about for a very long time and continue to think about. But I will say, I've talked a lot on this podcast about lit fic and about essay collections, but I actually read a lot of fantasy and love yeah. fantasy. So, and I read a lot of romance too. It took me a while to kind of like really get into romance, but I really enjoy it now. So I, even despite everything I've mentioned being very like literary fiction.
No, Casey is eating it up. So you are selling it.
Well, I'm happy somebody is. Great.
If you want one that makes you think, she forced us to read Tender as the Flesh, and I think about it once a week. And
I have not read yet.
Yeah,
it's you should. A lot.
I would love to. Yeah. I would. Yeah. I have a lot of, you know, what I kind of refer to as literary blind spots of just sort of like beloved classic, you know, books that I haven't gotten to yet, which I think is probably true of a lot of people, but some of my colleagues, I just, oh my God, they're just so deeply, deeply well read that it like makes you feel like you don't know anything. Like what right do I have to talk about books compared to these people who have like consumed the entire library's worth of literature? But that's
a conversation. We're deeply well read and face smut.
Yes. Well, okay, but that's its own area of study. Very valid.
It's what's trending right now. So it's what we've read a lot of recently, and we've had to sit here and be like, guys, we have to put books on our list that are more widely appealing.
Okay, trust me, face mutt is plenty widely appealing as judged by conversation and sales and the like. My God, I saw this video the other day of Sarah J. Maas at, she surprised readers at a book event. I don't even know where it was. And I mean, it was like Taylor Swift had walked into the room. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Which look, I love, I am all for authors being, you know, celebrated. But it is fascinating how and why she has become that in the literary world. But that's a subject of another podcast. I'm sure you guys have already discussed it many times.
Oh, we have.
She is one author where we are working through every one of her books because they're so popular. So every once in a while, we just sprinkle her in.
Let's just throw a little mass in there. I haven't read the whole series yet, but when the new Crescent City came out, the publisher sent me the first two, so that I could catch up on the series and slowly going to be making my way
thick that. Books.
Hefty they are, which again, I don't have a problem with. I think a book, you know, is as long as it should be as long as it should be. That doesn't necessarily mean it always ends up that way in the editing process, but I don't discriminate against big books, I'll put it that way.
We like big books here, so
exactly.
Well, I wanted to know if you've seen any trends or any changes in really what's popular, like what people are drawn to, what sort of the most read books are. And that could be anything like different genres on the come up, certain tropes, like, yeah, has anything changed?
I do think the way that people talk about fantasy, and this is actually a story that I'm sort of in the beginning phases of trying to work out what I want it to be and how I want to report it out. But I do think there has been a noticeable shift in how we talk about and consume fantasy. Fantasy has been popular for a very long time. You know, there's fantasy is not new. I think because of the Sarah J. Maas effect and the romanticy effect, there has been sort of this renewed conversation around it that I think gives the illusion that a lot of this is new. It's not. But I do think the way that we're talking about it is new. I do think some of the labels that we're using with specific types of fantasy is different. You know, cozy fantasy versus dark fantasy versus, you know, light academia, dark academia, all these types of things, urban fantasy, contemporary fantasy, you know. Again, those concepts are not new, but the way that we're talking about it, and I mean, even just like the way that we're describing tropes of grumpy meets sunshine, and like I saw this TikTok the other day that was basically talking about how, you know, if people 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even were like listening in on a book talk conversation, they would be like, what is this other language? Because it's all filtered through these like little like nicknames that people have come up with.
I think Catherine coined it like the trope trap.
Yes, trope trap. Exactly. Yeah. And look, I love a good trope. Like I think they're tropes work for a reason. There are stories that we're familiar with that resonate with us because they're familiar, and because they satisfy sort of an itch that we already recognize, that we know for the most part that we want. We just don't know the form in which we want it delivered. So I think there's a lot of value to tropes, but I do think specifically with fantasy, the combination of how those books are marketed, with how they're consumed, how they are discussed on book talk. You know, I see a lot of like trying to delineate between fantasy and magical realism and speculative fiction. And there are differences between those categories for sure. But I do think, you know, book genres can start to feel a little too much like fashion trends, kind of what you were saying, where everything has to fit into a box of like a certain core aesthetic, you know, ballet core, mob wife aesthetic, you know, all those types of things. I think I'm not saying those qualifiers aren't important as guideposts. It's just that I never want them to turn into boundaries. And I think it will be interesting as fantasy continues to sell and generate conversation to see if those delineations remain guideposts or if they do start to become, you know, sort of hard and fast rules, especially on like the marketing and publishing side. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I hesitate. No, I always hesitate to say anything's new in literature. I do think there are trends for sure. And maybe there are new ways in which those trends are making themselves known. But I don't think, like, for instance, I don't think that fantasy is like all of the sudden popular with women. Like that's, you know, like that's just not true. Like, I do think they're far more visible than perhaps they were in the height of, you know, the sort of.
I feel like women are less ashamed to admit they're reading these kind of romantasy books. And exactly. Now their husbands are reading them too.
Well, that's a whole nother thing too. I mean, there is sort of like a different, I hate this word, but like a different form of gatekeeping around it than what was experienced, you know, when I was growing up, for instance. But it's just a different manifestation of it, you know? It's not, I will say this, I do think the authors who are writing in the fantasy genre, that feels a lot more diverse in every sense of the word, like the types of fantasy. And not, I don't even just mean like dark fantasy versus light fantasy or whatever, but just like what fantasy means and how certain authors are interpreting it and how that's being received in sort of the marketplace, I do think is really, really intriguing right now. And I hope that that trend continues, of sort of our ideas of what fantasy can be, continue to expand. Yeah. I think that was the end of that thought.
Well, if you think about it, and it's something like I've always thought about, our generation grew up on YA dystopian fiction. Mm-hmm. So this is just an easy transition into adult fantasy, because it's essentially the same thing, except dystopian time period.
Well, and it's kind of like with Harry Potter, like when that blew up, you got a lot of other things that kind of rode its coattails into really great, you know, fantasy fiction. And I think it's kind of like you're saying, the SJM effect. There's a lot of things right now kind of, I don't want to say riding the coattails, but it's like opened the way for a lot of other books to kind of come into pop culture.
Absolutely. And I think my hope is that I don't, in a sense, have a problem with like, oh, okay, you know, fairy smut is very popular right now, so they're going to publish a bunch of like fairy smut books. Like, you know, that's just sort of the way that book publishing works and has worked for a very long time, of sort of following the business trends. But my hope is that, and I've seen this, you know, to some extent and anecdotally, of okay, yeah, dragons and, you know, the way that dystopia was really big, yes, when we were growing up, dragons are really big now. Okay, cool, great, that's fine, I love a good dragon. Is there something like really cool that an author of, you know, whether it's a certain background or a certain point of view or even just an idea that's a little bit different than the way that like we have consumed dragons for forever, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, mm-hmm. that's what's exciting to me, is that like, and that's, and again, that's what I was sort of saying about tropes even, is like, I love something that's familiar if it is then sort of funneled through the lens of something that's different. So that, I mean, then at the end of the
day, we kind of talked about that with Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of Fairies. Like, it's everything we love, but in a totally different way than what we've seen it before. And so seeing some of those pop up is really refreshing.
Absolutely. And that's what I think, you know, like R.F. Kuang, I think, has done mm-hmm. fairly well. And she's far from the only one, of like the magic system that she developed in Babel is not, it was very, very different in that it's focused on language and linguistics, but the actual manifestation of the magic itself is not like crazy new. Like, it was, you know, there's a word and it kind of like a spell, you know, there's a word and it creates an effect. But the way that she filtered that, A, in messaging of about colonialism and all of the things that that book tackles, but even just the mechanics of it were really inventive and really interesting. And I do think there's a lot of opportunity to do more of that in fantasy and in speculative fiction. And it is really exciting to me that hopefully, because of this quote unquote trend that we are seeing with SJM and Rebecca Yarros and, you know, a bajillion others, there will be more opportunities to do that kind of experimenting. That's my hope. I do know that it's also possible that the opposite is true, where it's like that becomes such a dominant force that that's the only thing that, you know, is not wanted, because I think people want more than that, but is bought, let's put it that mm-hmm. way.
So we've kind of talked about some of your favorites in the last year. For any who have not seen your articles on what to anticipate for 2024, and you've kind of talked about some of the stuff that's popular right now, like, what, if you were going to give like a little highlight reel, should people be looking forward to in 2024 in the book world?
Okay, so for literary fiction, the one that immediately comes to mind from our fiction list, and just to give my really quick spiel, the way that we do these lists is we're rolling them out currently. Right now, we've published our fiction, romance, and nonfiction ones, and our fantasy, sci-fi, and thriller ones are forthcoming, should be out here in the next like month, which is exciting. But we're updating those quarterly or almost quarterly throughout the year. So the idea is that every few months or so, there's going to be another group of books that kind of gets the spotlight.
And we'll link these in our show notes for anyone listening.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Appreciate the plug. But so I just, the only reason I say that is because there are books coming out later this year that we haven't, you know, written about yet that I am very, very excited about and that we will get to. But for now, for sort of the first quarter of the year, for fiction, I'm really, really excited about, okay, I want to say her name correctly. I believe it's Sochil Gonzalez's forthcoming novel, Anita De Monti Laughs Last. It's excellent. I don't want to say anything more about it other than it is about art and power dynamics and relationships, and it's excellent. For romance, I'd probably say How to End a Love Story by Yulin Huang. She is actually the screenwriter, I believe, for the film adaptation of Emily Henry's, I want to make sure I get my details right. I believe she's screenwriting one of the adaptations and directing the other. And it's Beach Read and People We Met on Vacation. But she's working on both of them, and she's written her own romance now, which is How to End a Love Story. And I apologize if I got my information mixed. So please also put that in the show notes.
Would you say then if you like Emily Henry, is she similar or different?
Yes. I mean, their voices are slightly different of course they are. But I do think it hits a lot of the same notes, I think, that Emily Henry hits and has a lot of the same thing, you know, attributes about it that I think people really love and resonate with in Emily's work. And I really enjoy Emily's work. She's one of my favorite romance novelists working today. I think that this is definitely their sort of I don't want to say aesthetics. Sensibilities are really aligned, which I think is why they're working together. I think it's a great one for fans of Emily, but also for those who maybe have never read her stuff and want, you know, something similar but of a different perspective. And then nonfiction. Okay, so this is a slightly different one. I have not been able to shut up about Hereafter by Amy Lin. It is hands down one of the most heartbreaking but beautiful books I've ever read about grief. It is a sort of poetic memoir. It's very short. It's a very quick read. If you can consume it in one sitting, which is hard because, I mean, it's very, very intense. It's very visceral. I cried multiple times reading it, but it is just beautiful. I don't want to give anything more away about it, but I was so deeply impressed on many levels by that book.
I know you said fantasy and like thriller aren't out yet, but are there any that you are personally looking forward to, even if they won't be on your list for this year?
Yes, always. Trying to think of, I'm really excited about the new Danielle Jensen. A Fate Inked in Blood. I was like, don't get it mixed up with something else. Beautyland is a sci-fi sort of lit fic combo that I think is really, really excellent and worth picking up. Oh, Emily Wilde's Map of the Otherlands. I am very excited about that one.
I just finished that like 2 days ago.
I haven't picked it up yet, and I'm
dying. I liked it better than the first one.
Did you? Okay, good. Because I've heard sort of both ways. I've heard people say that it's better, and others that are like, oh, I loved the first one so much.
Got a 6-week wait at the library. I'm very mad about it.
Ugh, rough. Oh, I am excited. What do you guys think about, and have any of you read, although I don't think it's out. Is it out now? Yeah, it's out now. Allie Hazelwood's fantasy, Bride.
I was just telling them today, I was like, this is getting book talk discussion because it's...
Yeah, I'm dying to read this one because I've heard a lot of the...
Casey hates Allie Hazelwood, but I'm like, we may have to do this one because it's not your normal rom-com.
Everyone said that it's really different from her other stuff. So, there was somebody I came across that was like, oh, I usually hate Allie Hazelwood, but this one
Casey worked for them, I guess. Casey hates Allie Hazelwood.
Catherine and I love Allie Hazelwood.
Yeah.
I'm excited about A Tempest of Tea, which is YA fantasy, but I've heard really good things about that one.
I've seen that one popping up a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm interested. I don't know if excited is the right word, but I'm very interested in Leigh Bardugo's new book. When is that coming out? That's April.
Is it part of her series or new completely?
It's a standalone. I don't think it has anything to do. I mean, it's adult, but it's, I don't think it's tied to Ninth House in any way.
I want the third Ninth House.
I know.
Yeah,
me too.
You kind of mentioned a book to screen adaptation in the Emily Henry coming soon. And you cover film and television. What has been your favorite book to screen adaptation so far?
Isn't it wild how many there are? I mean,
yes. Crazy.
Truly, like the literary community is holding up Hollywood at this point. IP is everything. And that even is not new. It's just it's so ubiquitous at this point. Oh my gosh. Okay. So last year we had several really noteworthy ones. Fellow Travelers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Lessons in Chemistry, Daisy Jones, Silo, I thought was a good one. Survival of the Thickest, which was a memoir sort of fictionalization, but I thought that was such a fun show. The Hunger Games prequel. Leave the World Behind. I'm just listing them off at this point, but I could go on and on and on. But if I'm being honest, the one that sort of immediately springs to mind is probably Dune. That book is really important to me for a number of reasons. And it was satisfying to see it made into a deserving movie. I think there are plenty of worthy criticisms, both of that book and that film and sort of that whole franchise. But I do think it is a really essential work of science fiction. And obviously I'm far from alone in thinking that. And so to see it adapted, especially after so much stopping and starting and you know, such a long journey to the screen, at least in this form, it was really validating is maybe a word for it, or just sort of like, you know, when you see an adaptation of a book that you loved and it's not exactly how you imagined it, and there are some nitpicks that you have, but it feels like the book, you know, you start to have sort of feeling in your chest of like, yeah, I mean, you get it. Like, you're like, oh yeah, this is, it's not the same, but it's giving me that same sort of that sense of richness and almost comfort, but like not in a like, oh, like I'm cozy sort of comfort, but just like
Dune creates a very precise world.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So bringing that to life is a high bar.
It's affirming. I can't think of the right word for it, but just something about like, yeah, I think it is validating because it's like the thing that I felt, the thing that I imagined, oh, here is that feeling again, that it wasn't just a whim. It wasn't just a one-time thing. Like here it is again. there is something really special and frankly rare about that. And it's also exciting to see something that is a little bit different than how you imagined. You know, how does someone else interpret these same characters and the same story? It's one of the reasons I do really love writing about TV and movies, especially when they are adaptations, is because it's fascinating to me how so many different people can have such vastly different interpretations. And it gets back to our original point about, you know, all books being questions as opposed to answers. So yeah, I don't know. Again, I have plenty of criticisms of Dune, but I did really enjoy the viewing experience of that movie.
Okay, but did you see the popcorn bucket?
It's brilliant. I don't care what anybody says. It is absolutely brilliant that it accomplished exactly what they wanted it to accomplish.
But I'm not sticking my hand in it.
No.
I mean, of course not. And
it's a collector's piece. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to buy one, but if someone just magically procured one for me and was like, here, would you like this? I'd be like, yeah, absolutely. Are you joking? It's the Dune popcorn bucket. I'll put it on my bookshelf. And that's the point. They wanted it to be a novelty thing that everyone talked about. And it became, you know, I just, the moment I saw it, truly, I was like, that is how you do movie marketing. That is brilliant.
I just saw like blindfolded people putting their hand in that bucket and they were all extremely grossed out. And they're like, is this sexual? What is this?
I liked them interviewing all the cast about them and everyone else was like, ew. And Dave Bautista was like, I just kept sticking my hand in.
I saw that exact. I love him like that. And I love that energy. I really do. Like, he's like, y'all are weirdos. Stop making it weird. It's fun. Just enjoy it. Like, I love it. I really do.
Well, we've done a couple, like we did Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes on the pod because the movie was coming out. I don't think I'll convince these two to read Dune though. So
that's okay. It is a bit of a investment. I do think it's an excellent book.
It's a hefty book. And then you get to the end and realize there's how many more.
God, I have only read Dune. I hope I'm going to be getting Dune Messiah soon because that's another adaptation that is happening at some point. But the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes is definitely a bit more accessible, but still very interesting to discuss. I mean, obviously lots of political connotations in that one.
Yep. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, this is a two-part question kind of, but A, what does your day-to-day look like? Mm-hmm. And B, what does it feel like when you get to do all like the super glamorous stuff? Like you get to go to the awards and talk to stars and write about things that are super popular, like the Barbie movie.
Generally speaking, I sort of start my day with emails. I look ahead to my schedule. If I have interviews, you know, I make sure that I've slotted in like an hour at least, depending on the interview, beforehand to prepare. Usually I've started my preparations a couple weeks in advance, if not longer, depending on the kind of story. But I like to give myself sort of that like hour buffer right beforehand to sort of go through my questions, make sure everything's ready to go. So yeah, mornings are usually like emails, edits. Sometimes there's breaking news. I don't do a whole lot of the breaking news for our, you know, site/magazine. But every once in a while, it'll be sort of an all hands on deck situation. And then through the rest of the day, I start having interviews and meetings. I try to reserve at least a couple of days that are strictly for writing. Sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't, but that's the goal usually, so that I have that kind of uninterrupted time. If I don't have that, then I slot it in, you know, in between meetings and emails and interviews, and sometimes it goes into the evening. I try really hard to keep my hours, you know, working hours, but it just sort of depends. And then in terms of reading and making time to read, I do a lot of reading during my commute. I read a lot on the weekends. I read in the evenings. I always have a book with me. So if I'm waiting in line for coffee or whatever it is, I sometimes will pull out my phone, but really, really try to pull out my book instead. So yeah, that's kind of a brief overview of what like an average day is. And as far as the like glamour of it all, it's an interesting question because it strangely enough was not really a part of the job that I had anticipated. And I don't know if that's just my own naivete coming from, you know, the middle of Missouri, which is not glamorous. You know, I mean, I've been to some nice places in Columbia. I love Columbia, Missouri, but
it's not glamorous.
You know, I wouldn't disgrace. It's not a place that, you know, unless Travis Kelce is in town, there are no celebrities, generally speaking, in Columbia. And so there is definitely a different energy and a different expectation of you in those types of settings. And there's times that I have really, really enjoyed that. And I do enjoy, it's fun to get dressed up and to have sort of access to the people and the atmosphere that those events create. I love a good party. People will say the darndest things at parties. You can do some really great reporting at parties. It's why there are party reporters. I mean, you get some excellent story ideas at parties. But I do think, you know, galas and red carpets and awards shows and things like that all kind of come with their own set of etiquette that I think you really only learn until you've done it. And that can be challenging, just sort of like learning how to fit in that atmosphere and recognizing both that it's an enormous privilege to be there, but also that you are not like the star of the night. You're there to do a job and to enjoy yourself. Sure, you know, you can have your champagne and all of that, and you should if you drink and if you want to, but at the same time, like, you're there to work, you're there to notice what's going on, you're there to pay attention, you're there to talk to people. So it's sort of an odd combination of like, wow, pinch me, like, I can't believe I'm here. I never imagined in my wildest dreams, frankly, that I would be in some of these rooms talking to some of these people, while at the same time having the very like grounding instinct of like, I'm doing my job and my work, and not in like a I'm doing my job sort of way, but in a like, you know, stay focused, don't get sort of too caught up in the like glamour of it all. Plus also there's enough elements of it that aren't glamorous that it kind of like tempers out at the end of the day of like, yeah, you'll have a really, really like amazing evening where you like talk to, you know, Jennifer Aniston or whatever, and you're in a ball gown and all of those things. And then the next day, you know, you're up at 6 a.m. writing about something, some album drop and the scandal that's going on with that, and trying to talk to publicists in the middle of it, and you don't have any sleep and you haven't had your coffee yet. And, you know, look, I mean, in the grand scheme of difficulties, that is very, very low on the list. But I would not describe that as glamorous. So it just sort of depends, but it is something I feel very, very, very deeply privilege to have access to, and something that I really try to take pains to appreciate for what it is, while at the same time not being kind of under the spell of it too much, let's put it that way.
I think we have one last question for you, and so in the spirit of this being the Busy Girls Book Club, we give all our books a busy girl rating. So we'll give them a quality rating and then a busy girl rating. So like, how easy is it to fit into a busy schedule? Is it worth taking that time? Like, is it easy to pick up and put down? Is it widely appealing? If you were to pick a busy girl's book purely for the fact that it's really easy to fit in your schedule and worth the time, do you have one or, you know, two or three, if you were going to recommend, and it doesn't have to be something you've read in the past year, even just like What'd you recommend to our readers?
Okay. Have you guys read Fourth Wing?
Yes.
Yeah, done it. Okay. So that would not be my recommendation quite. I do think everyone who talks about books, writes about books, and I do very much include like the very high caliber literary critics, I do think they should read this book. Not because I think it is some astounding work of literature, but because I think it says a lot about publishing right now. And I do think it is all of those things that you just mentioned. I do think it's very easy to read. I think it's, you know, page turning, you know, all of those types of things. So that was one that came to mind of like, I do think that if people can fit that book, especially people who like want to do any form of literary criticism at whatever level.
That is our highest reaching episode of all time.
Well, yep. Exactly. Like I do sometimes take issue with like, okay. How do I begin? A lot of people think that book is bad. I have a lot of feelings about that book, some very positive, some very negative. But for the sake of argument, if you are someone who really thinks that book is terrible, and I think you would, you know, a lot of people would validate that opinion, I still think you should read it. It's what we were talking about earlier. Like, this book is so ubiquitous. It's so telling of the environment that we are in. It is so, it's just so telling. Like this is a subject for another episode, but it's one of those books where I'm like, if you've been ignoring it and you care about like literature and about sort of, I do think you should read it, or at least like, you know, read half of it or whatever. Like, it's something you should know about.
Well, whether you like it or not, there's things to discuss. Yeah, like,
exactly.
It makes a good discussion.
Maybe that is a little too, like, I don't know, populist of me or whatever you want to call it. But I don't really think it is, because again, I'm not saying like, oh my God, everyone needs to read this because it's so amazing. It's more like, this is what people are talking about. This is what the literary community is sort of.
Yeah, like I said, it's our top reaching episode. And despite doing it months and months ago, people still go listen to it weekly.
Exactly.
It's blown all our other episodes out of the water. So people are interested.
I'll leave it at that for now. Again, if you want to have me back at some point, we can do a really deep dive on Fourth Wing, round two for you guys. But I think the book that I really, really, truly like come back to all the time and do think that, you know, everyone should read or that it would be a good read for a lot of people, I'll say it that way, is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. It's lit fic, but it is, I find to be very accessible lit fic, but still very, very beautiful, very moving. The television adaptation is excellent, by the way, if you haven't watched. It is so rich and captivating and fully realized without, you know, relying too much on tropes, which isn't to say there aren't tropes. I mean, it's a post-apocalyptic, you know, a virus wiped out
pandemic fiction. I recommend reading fiction. It in 2020 like I did, because that was a terrible choice.
A lot of people did.
It was my book club's choice, but that was a terrible choice.
It's a book I would it's actually a good point. I do think the context around it has changed a little bit because of the pandemic, but I even in my opinion think that has made it almost more accessible, because I think it feels so much more real. And it's short, you know, I mean, it's not short, but it's short enough that you can carry it around in your bag. And I relish that book every time I read it. And it sort of, you know, gets at what I was talking about earlier about like that book is a speculative fiction. It's not fantasy. I mean, it doesn't really have any magic to it in a strict sense, but it has sort of some of those same attributes. Like, it feels like a fantasy, if that makes any sense. I don't know. It is a book that I have read, oh gosh, a handful of times now. I don't know. I'm trying to, I've read a lot of lit fic over the years, and I love it very, very much for a lot of reasons, but I'm also trying to explore more like so-called genre fiction. Not that, I mean, cause I've been reading that for forever. But I think to our point earlier about fantasy, like those genres are tend to be covered by specific outlets. So, you know, like Crime Reads covers thrillers and, oh my gosh, what's the outlet that does like really specifically fantasy? I cannot believe I'm blanking on the name, but you know, it's these specific publications that are devoted to a specific genre. And I think one of my goals for Elle and for myself is to stop thinking in that way of sort of like, oh, all readers are like thriller readers or romance readers. That can be certainly be true, that that's the bulk of what somebody reads. But a lot of people read a variety of different things, especially if they self-identify as a reader. So anyway, that's like a big goal of mine for the rest of this year, is not to read less literary fiction, but to read more genre fiction and sort of dig into that a little bit deeper.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything else that you want to tell our listeners?
I don't think so. I feel like I've gabbed for quite a while now. I guess I will say, you know, if you are interested in any of the books coverage that we're doing over at Elle, you can go over to Elle.com. It's in the culture section under what to read in 2024. You can also find me on most social media apps, websites, etc., at Lore Puckett, LaurPuckett as in Paul, UCKETT. And I would love to talk to anybody who slides in my DMs about books anytime. So please, you are more than welcome to.
Well, thank you again, Lauren. And we'll be sure to link some of your articles in our show notes and try and get some of your recommendations either in the show notes, or maybe we'll put up a blog post where people can kind of reference different things we've discussed. And you know, listeners, you can find all that at Busy Girls Pod, busygirlspod.com. That's where you'll find that stuff. Let us know if any of the books Lauren recommended are ones you want us to tackle for the pod. Yep. I'm Caitlin.
I'm Catherine.
And I'm Casey. Thanks for listening. And when you get a chance, take a break with the Busy Girls Book Club.